Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom. I'm here with my co-host today, Dave Allen. We're going to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. And today is Thursday, June 3rd, 2028. Happy belated birthday, Dave.
Well, hello there. Thank you very much.
Yes. Yeah, see, if you did programs every day, I wouldn't have been belated.
I know. I was hiding from you.
Yes. I hope you had a great day.
Topped off by that creme brulee. I must say it was a fine ending.
All right. Well, it was... Well, if you were buying gold and silver today, it was a fine ending for the day. But so just hang in there. Even for those of you who bought yesterday, no worries. You know, we had a big hit on gold today, down $36 at $1,872. You have silver down 70 cents at $27.56. So, you know, not a bad day. Platinum was down 30 at $1,166. Palladium was down 12 at $2,894. So I would assume the USDX got a little bit stronger today, all based on the expectations of tomorrow's job reports. The USDX today was up 0.57, brought it back up over 90.48. Crude oil was up another 2 cents at 68.85. The Dow ends flat. Well, actually, it's not flat. You know, you can call 23 points of the negative flat, I guess. 34,577. S&P was down 15 at 41.92. NASDAQ was down 141 at 13,614. So I'd have to assume that the 10-year is a little bit stronger today. Yes, it is, 1.627. And Europe, mix, half up, half down. Asia, half up, half down. So it's kind of a trend around the world last night and today. And I'm not quite sure, Dave, haven't had a chance to really follow the news today like I normally do. So didn't really have a chance to see if there was one major component that hit the markets, you know, really other than the jobs report for tomorrow, I would think.
Well, you know, you would have...
And profit-taking.
You would have expected the today's and tomorrow's anticipated job report to have a stronger, a more positive effect on stocks. They certainly, the good job report and the anticipated numbers tomorrow, close to a million, as well as the ISM numbers that were released today, just all around bad for gold, and it never got a chance after that sell-off to recover. But tomorrow is TGIF. It's another day for investors.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, some reporting indicates that some of the Fed presidents, some of their comments could have hit, you know, as the Fed is going to start pulling back. They're going to scale back buying when the economy has made a substantial further progress.
Well, they're going to talk about it. They're going to talk about when they're going to start talking about it.
So and then they'll think about it.
Yeah, ain't no tapering in the near future just yet.
No. And so anyway, so the jobless claims that comes out on Thursdays, that fell below 400,000, you know, for the first time since the early of last year. First time filings for unemployment benefits totaled 385,000 for the week ending May 29th. And of course, the previous week was 405,000. The last time we saw claims as slow was March 14th of last year. And I don't know if there's anything else interesting in there, Dave, that you might want to pick out and share with the listeners.
Well, I think it's good to keep in mind that there's still over 15 million Americans receiving unemployment benefits. many of them, the pandemic, unemployment benefits in place since last year. The good news is that that total now is about half of where it was at the worst point last summer, or late spring, I should say. Now, these total claim numbers are expected to continue their decline as more people return to their jobs and more states start curtailing the federal benefits. There are now at least 22 states, I believe, that have stopped them. And then with the federal government program set to expire in September, short of any further extension by Congress, that will, you know, end them as well. So now we continue to hear too, Melody, that, I mean, the Fed's latest beige book out yesterday shows that many businesses all around the country are having a hard time still finding workers to fill vacancies. And it says specifically the lack of job candidates prevented some firms from increasing output and, less commonly, led some businesses to reduce their hours of operation.
Well, you know, right before the jobs report Friday, ADP's private payroll count done in conjunction with Moody's Analytics, they said that the private job growth for May accelerated. And, of course, these are going to, again, are going to everything's going to show acceleration. And the fastest pace in a year. Well, hello, the world was shut down, you know, for a year. So, yeah. So, again, these numbers are so skewed. But it will be interesting to see. They're looking at, it was a 48% jump from April, 654,000. They showed nearly, companies had hired 970,000 workers. You know, if the government doesn't make those numbers tomorrow, I think there'll be a lot of disappointment, don't you think?
Not for precious metal investors.
No. That's for sure. Come on, government. Tell us the truth and lie about it. And don't lie to the good side. Tell us the truth.
It was a favor.
Yeah, but... So the two numbers could differ substantially, as they did in April when the official count showed just 266,000 new jobs compared with expectations of a million. So the chief economist at ADP, Nella Richardson, said private payroll showed a marked improvement, of course, from recent months and the strongest gains since the early days of the recovery, Dave.
Yeah, now education and health services added the 139,000, while the most came from healthcare, while trade, transportation, and utilities contributed 118,000. The largest, the ADP report, 440,000 new jobs added. In leisure and hospitality. Again, not surprising since that was the sector most affected by the lockdowns. Now, overall services added 850,000 jobs, and the balance made up by good producing companies. The government non-farm payroll account for May is expected to show growth of 671,000 tomorrow. And a drop in the U3 government unemployment rate to 5.9%. Now, that equates to a real jobless rate of between 10%, applying the government's U6 pool of people, and shadowstats.com's 25.5%, which includes long-term discouraged job hunters and those who've stopped looking altogether. So, ain't out of the woods yet, Melody.
No, and again, I mean, look at the difference in numbers and how they can skew the numbers just by changing the equations.
Yeah.
And it's just not with this number. It's with most of the numbers, you know, that are given to us. And if they don't like the numbers, they change the way GDP just, always cracks me up. They get three tries to get it right.
Stop the Pollyanna reporting of these numbers. I mean, people can take it. You know, paper investors, obviously it had tad to a lot more jittery. But still, get us to the right numbers and you know, report from there. And then if nothing else, at least, you know, there are going to be less people raising their eyebrows every month and perhaps more people saying, well, okay, all right, well, that's credible, or more credible, I should say. But anyway.
Well, we have another sector. U.S. service providers expanded at the fastest pace on record in May. And of course, it highlights the improvement in business activity across the country. The Institute for Supply Management Services Index rose to 64 last month. Of course, this is the highest to data back to 1997. Okay, the figures underscore rising demand for a host of services like, again, air travel, hotel, stays, meals, out as social activity picks up. And anything else in there that's worth mentioning, Dave?
Well, you know, it's just that the growth was all around in all of the 18 service industries. You know, retailers, wholesalers, construction firms, surprisingly, entertainment, recreation. Again, the prices paid for materials, that advanced too to the second highest level on record as the gauge of order backlogs at the service providers continued climbing to a record high. We're also seeing delivery times stretching out as well. Now, there's one economist who says even if all businesses right now tried to reopen everything tomorrow, they couldn't do it because they don't have the labor. There it is again. They don't have the production capabilities. So again, we're seeing similar things. Yeah, rising numbers on the one hand, but production labor challenges on the other, Melody.
Well, this is the article that I think is really interesting. I only saw it discussed a little bit in early morning programming, and it was about Russia is cutting the U.S. dollar from its $186 billion national wealth fund, and as they keep getting hit with sanctions from Washington. This move was announced at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum by their finance minister, Anton Sulanov, who said that the National Wealth Fund will instead invest in the euro, the Chinese yuan, and gold assets. But you know what's interesting, though? All things are connected because we know Biden, they're now able to finish their pipeline to Germany. So now it's interesting now that they come out and announce that they're going to be investing in the euro. And it's just all things are connected. Mm-hmm. The changes to the wealth fund are expected to happen within the next month. Once complete, the share of euro assets in the fund is expected to stand at 40%. The fund is expected to stand at 40%, the yuan at 30%, and gold at 20%. And then you're going to have the yen and the British pound likely will make up about 5%. And Timothy Ash, a Blue Bay asset manager, described the decision to ditch dollar assets as very political. No kidding, Sherlock. And one that's meant to send a signal to President Biden ahead of the upcoming summit with Putin. Ash added the messaging is we don't need the U.S., we don't need to transact in dollars, and we are invulnerable to more U.S. sanctions. The White House imposed, of course, all these new sanctions against Moscow. And so, Dave, we'll see. I don't think this is positioning going into that meeting. I think they would have done it anyway. I don't know. What say you?
Well, I could take either position, I think. I tend to think that for his internal politics, that he, Putin, needed to send a message before the two heads of state do meet. So I kind of do think it is, you know, timing meant to, I don't know, provide a sense of momentum, maybe, as they go into the summit. But it's also quite possible that, that it's not, that they were indeed going to do this anyway as a response to the sanctions that were put in back in April. And it just, I mean, things, reactions, things, moves like this do take time to cover their bases, even in the autocratic or totalitarian society, government. Now, we know that this National Wealth Fund was originally set up to support Russia's pension system. It forms part of Russia's gold and currency reserves that were $601 billion at the end of last month. So, very interesting. Moscow published a paper on a digital ruble middle of last fall and aims to have a prototype ready by the end of this year, with pilot programs starting next. And more than one official now saying that that could be a concern for the U.S., particularly if it's Russia, China, and Iran, with the new central bank digital currency that operates outside of the dollar, and if that led to other countries, east and west, following them. So either way, it's interesting, Melody. We'll certainly be following this in the months ahead to see what we're hearing, particularly as these digital currencies in these other countries come online. I just hope it doesn't lead to, well, they have it, now we've got to have it as well.
And really, in today's world, $186 billion from a government is really pittance.
Yes, that's a pittance. That's a really good point.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, we're heading into the first break. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody the rest of this program today as she takes care of customers in the office, where you can reach her at 1-800-375-4188, 375-4188, toll free. Now, as Melody alluded to at the top of the program today, I guess you could add Philadelphia Fed Prez Patrick Harker to Wall Street's bad list. This morning, Harker said that the Federal Reserve should begin discussing the time frame for paring back its beloved pandemic-era bond-buying program. I think it's appropriate for us to slowly, carefully move back on our purchases at the appropriate time. Harker said that during a virtual Women in Housing and Finance event this morning. The Fed continues to buy $120 billion of treasury and mortgage-backed securities every month as part of the policy program it put in place last year to, let's say it, prop up the paper markets. Fed officials have said they'll begin scaling back the purchases when the economy has made, quote, substantial further progress toward their goals, a condition that many Fed watchers believe could be met now as early as later this year. I still think it'll be at sometime in 2022. Harker sits on the Federal Open Market Committee, but doesn't have a vote on policy decisions this year. They rotate that role among the governors. Minutes of the April FOMC meeting showed that a number of participants suggested that if the economy continued to make rapid progress toward the committee goals, vis-a-vis inflation and employment, it might be appropriate at some point in upcoming meetings to begin discussing a plan for adjusting the pace of asset purchases. Well, to me, ladies and gentlemen, that means no changes continuing for now, as the Fed's mantra. Now, just a quickie here. We'll just, I think it's important. Car makers' new vehicle inventory has dropped to a record low in the U.S. as the global chip shortage hampers efforts to keep up with voracious auto demand. Inventory on dealer lots stood at just 23 days supply at the end of May. That's down from 33 days just 1 month earlier. The industry norms around 60 days. At $38,225, the average price of all new vehicles set another all-time monthly high. Cars are expected to keep getting costlier as the supply-starved dealers slash sales incentives until semiconductor availability improves. One analyst thinks that things won't normalize in that industry, inventory in particular, until 2023, 2024 even. That means there's going to be a lot. Hold on to your vehicle, I think, is the moral of that story. Now, it's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. NASA, another story about the space agency, is returning to red hot Venus, our closest yet perhaps most overlooked neighbor, after decades of exploring other worlds. The space agency's new administrator, Bill Nelson, announced two new robotic missions to the solar system's hottest planet. I'm surprised to read that. I just assumed it would be Mercury. during his first major address to employees yesterday. He said, "These two sister missions both aim to understand how Venus became an inferno-like world capable of melting lead at the surface. One mission named Da Vinci Plus will analyze the thick, cloudy Venusian atmosphere in an attempt to determine whether the inferno planet ever had an ocean and possibly was habitable. A small craft reportedly will plunge through the atmosphere to measure the gases. It will be the first U.S.-led mission to the Venus atmosphere since 1978. Now, the other mission, called Veritas, will seek a geologic history by mapping the rocky planet's surface." That seems to make sense and have a long-term value. NASA scientist Tom Wagner said, "It's astounding how little we know about Venus, but these new missions, will give fresh views of the planet's atmosphere made up mostly of carbon dioxide down to its core. It will be as if we have rediscovered the planet." NASA's top science official, Thomas Zurbuchen, calls it a new decade of Venus. Each mission, launching sometime between 2028 and 2030, will receive $500 million for development under NASA's Discovery program. The missions beat out two other proposed pod projects to Jupiter's moon Io and Neptune's icy moon Triton. The U.S. and the former Soviet Union sent multiple spacecraft to Venus in the early days of space exploration. NASA's Mariner 2 performed the first successful flyby in 1962, and the Soviets' Venera 7 made the first successful landing in 1970. Then in 1989, NASA used the Space Shuttle to send its Magellan spacecraft into orbit around Venus. The European Space Agency put a spacecraft around Venus in 2006. Now, I'm not sure if we'll be around to report on the mission's findings at the end of the decade, but someone will be here and we'll be on the lookout for the results. In the meantime, how about we focus a little bit more on making our own planet a little more livable and peace-loving? Okay with you, ladies and gentlemen? And that is this week's Levity is Golden. Now, President Joe, he wants the R's to increase the spending in their infrastructure plan ahead of talks tomorrow. These talks are going to shape whether Washington has the muster to pass a bipartisan bill to upgrade transportation, broadband, and water systems. What's that sound I hear? Yeah, I'm afraid I have to agree with that. Hopeful as I would be for a bipartisan bill, just for the sake of it, I just don't think the muster's there. The two sides are, I think, much too far apart to get to a point where there's going to be a bipartisan deal. Where it will end up, who knows? We know that during a meeting yesterday, Biden told GOP Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia that he wants their plan to include $1 trillion in new spending, additional spending, above the baseline set under existing policy. While Republicans most recently sent the White House a $928 billion counteroffer, it included only about $250 billion in new money. Biden also reiterated that he wants to fund an infrastructure bill by hiking the corporate tax rate. The GOP opposes any changes to its 2017 tax law, which slashed the corporate tax to 21% from 35%. The president also offered an alternative to try to win over Republicans. He proposed relying on a 15% minimum tax designed to curb underpayment by profitable American companies. Despite the offer, however, Biden's not scrapping his plans to hike the corporate rate to at least 25% or raise taxes on wealthy individuals making over 400,000 a year. Not sure where that's going to go again, but the parties haven't even agreed on the particulars. I mean, the money aside, what fixes need to go into bill? They have disagreements about what the definition of infrastructure is. You know, Biden's offering a much more expansive definition, include the family infrastructure, for child care, child tax credits, paid family leave, and what have you. But Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm did say there's a time limit on negotiations, which suggests that the White House could and the Democratic Senate could try to go on their own without any Republican votes if they don't get agreement by next week. Now, the White House is also placing global anti-corruption efforts at the center of U.S. foreign policy. They've issued a new directive to federal agencies to prioritize efforts to identify and tackle corruption. The instructions came in the form of a national security study memorandum released today, the first of the Biden presidency. The memo formally establishes the fight against corruption as a core national security interest. The memo is important because it publicly notifies federal agencies that they need to up their anti-corruption game. Major parts of the directive reportedly will be focused on financial crimes, which I think is a really good thing, including steps to modernize existing anti-corruption laws to confront cryptocurrencies and cybercrime. One official said, "We're looking at crypto as a means of illicit finance, but by no means are these steps limited to new technologies like crypto." The official also said that the effort would likely involve updates to the Bank Secrecy Act. It's the primary means that law enforcement uses to track how money moves through financial institutions to try and uncover illegal money laundering. According to the memo, the federal government will also robustly implement new rules established in January this year that require American companies to report their beneficial owner or owners to the Treasury Department. That's part of an effort aimed at reducing offshore financial secrecy, as well as to improve information sharing and identifying the need for other new reforms. So, just last before we leave this, the so-called foreign policy for the middle class, as the administration is calling it, aims to ensure that the globalization, trade, human rights, and military might are all harnessed for the benefit of working Americans. I'm sure implicit in that is all Americans, not leave the interest of working Americans, poor Americans, behind. Moving overseas, Japan, surprisingly, still has more semiconductor factories than any other country in the world. Problem is, most of them are outdated. Few of them are cutting edge anymore. Now, that dreary self-assessment, along with a global chip shortage that continues to crimp auto sales around the world, particularly Japan auto production, is the reason the Japanese government's planning to ramp up research and development funding for the industry. In the 1980s, Japan was the world's biggest maker of microchips, but it ceded most of that business to regional peers since then, South Korea and Taiwan. Only Sony remains as a leading maker of image sensors, although many less well-known firms are still key suppliers of the tools and other components needed to make chips. The latest growth plan, which follows similar moves to boost homegrown semiconductors in the U.S. and China, doesn't say how much public money Japan will invest to reboot its chip industry. But it does plan to make a powerful case that more spending is needed. Here are the main points. Japan's share of global semiconductor sales dwindled to just 10% in 2019. That's down from 50% in 1988. Again, the country still has 84 chip factories, the most in the world, but they're not producing enough high-end products. As a result, Japan now has to import just about two-thirds of its semiconductors. And last, the country makes no chips with the most sophisticated sub-10 nanometer circuitry. That's where Taiwan and South Korea dominate. So it'll be interesting. So far, deft inventory management by Toyota, in particular, has helped Japan's auto industry avoid the kind of factory stoppages being seen at General Motors or Stellantis. But a lot of Japanese economists are saying there's a lot of potential for trouble in the coming months. Now, in the remaining time left in this segment, the White House plans to amend a U.S. ban on investments in companies linked to China's military this week after the Trump-era policy was challenged in court. That left investors confused about the extent of the ban's reach. Under Biden's amended order, the Treasury Department will create a list of companies that could face financial penalties for their connection to China's defense and surveillance technology sectors. Until now, the finance sanctions and selection of targeted companies were tied to a congressionally mandated Defense Department report. The amended order, which the president is expected to sign later this week, will change the criteria for blacklisting entities to capture those that operate in the defense or surveillance sectors. Biden administration is set to keep a large number of previously listed entities and Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control will add new ones as part of the order. That looks to, you know, shake up that industry. No specific word about companies like Huawei, who were it and its subsidiaries a large focus of the previous administration's ire in this regard. Hear that sound? It means we're heading off for a couple of important messages. Please stick around. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm your host, Dave Allen. Melody in the office at 800-375-4188. Well, Israelites chanting BB, BB, BB. Unfortunately for him, it appears a slight minority of them are saying, BB, please stay. The others are saying, BB, go home. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his opponents pushed today for a quick parliament vote to formally end his lengthy rule, I think 12 years. They're hoping to head off any last-minute attempts by the premier to derail their newly announced coalition government. The latest political maneuvering began just hours after opposition leader Yair Lapid and his main coalition partner, Naftali Bennett, declared they had reached a deal to form a new government and muster a majority in the 120-member parliament, Knesset. The coalition consists of eight parties from across the political spectrum with the shared goal of toppling Netanyahu after his dozen years in power. The alliance includes hardliners previously allied with the BB, as well as center-left parties and even an Arab faction, which is a first there. Netanyahu lashed out at his foes, signaling that he will continue to exert pressure on former ideological allies who joined the Lapid or the Lapid-Bennett coalition. He wrote on Twitter, "All members of Knesset who were elected with right-wing votes need to oppose this dangerous leftist government." The anti-Netanyahu bloc announced the coalition deal just before a deadline at midnight last night, actually midnight Wednesday, going into Wednesday. The agreement triggered a complex process that's likely to stretch over the next week. The new coalition commands a razor-thin majority of 61 votes in the 120-member parliament. Now the question whether the group's votes will hold together to name a new speaker. The speaker presides over Knesset and requires that oversight to confirm the new coalition government. Big news in the Middle East. Back to the States here. Now, answer me this. What's a reverse repo issued by the Federal Reserve? Well, according to the New York Fed, in a nutshell, it's when counterparties loan the Fed money in exchange for some collateral, say Treasury bills. Recently, the New York Fed, acting on behalf of the Federal Reserve as a whole, has been selling Treasuries to Wall Street banks, trading houses, mutual funds, and government-sponsored enterprises. The sales come in overnight and weekend deals and pay zero or next to zero interest when it buys back the securities, usually a day or two later, sometimes a little bit longer. Cameron Russ Martins of Wall Street on Parade asked, "Now, why would the smartest guys on Wall Street who never let a loose dime slip through their fingers to get a larger cut of the annual bonus pool be willing to loan the Fed money at 0% interest? I mean, these are, after all, some of the same guys making 10-to-1 margin loans to dodgy family office hedge funds like Archegos Capital Management to maximize fee income. Everyone on Wall Street seems to have their own idea about what caused reverse repos at the New York Fed to skyrocket during the last month, May, that is. One of the frequently mentioned theories right now is that there's a surplus of cash swashing around Wall Street as a result of the latest $1.9 trillion stimulus bill passed by Congress in March and the resulting surge in bank and money market fund deposits. Martin say, hold on 1 minute. There's a problem with that. They point to a New York Fed spreadsheet on its daily reverse repos, where the dollar amounts went from a low of $3.45 billion on April 5th, that's the month after the stimulus bill was passed and stimulus checks went out, to a high of $173 billion on April 30th, less than a month later. The huge surge in the Fed's reverse repos occurred in May, not April, and has continued into the first days of June. During the last week of May, the Fed's overnight reverse repos ranged from $369 billion on May 21st to an all-time high of $485 billion, a little less than 1 week later. In the case of the May 21st reverse repo, which fell on a Friday, that deal wasn't an overnight operation but lasted through the weekend, maturing on Monday the 24th. The counterparties that took Treasury collateral from the Fed and loaned it $369 billion for the weekend earned zero interest, according to the Fed. Another theory making the rounds is that corporations are wary of parking their idle cash in money market funds, holding securities other than U.S. government paper. Why? Well, because the Fed had to create a bailout program for those non-government paper money market funds last March. During that crisis, since Treasury money market funds, which countless corporations, institutions, and pension funds are flocking to, typically can't hold anything longer than a one-year instrument, there may be a surge in demand to get their hands on one-year Treasury bills. Well, whatever is causing the rising fear on Wall Street, the Martins say there's no question that the fear is spreading to more firms that do business with the New York Fed. For example, just in April, the number of counterparties engaging in reverse repos with the Fed went from a low of 4 on April 5th to 38 on April 29th. During the last week of May, the number of daily counterparties ranged from 54 on May 24th to 50 counterparties on May 27th, the day that the Fed's reverse repos hit that historic high, $485 billion. The Fed's minutes for its Federal Open Market Committee meeting of March 16th and 17th reflect a significant amount of discussion about the Fed's reverse repos. One directive coming out of that discussion was for the New York Fed to do this, conduct, and I'm quoting here, conduct overnight reverse repurchase agreement operations at an offering rate of 0.00% and with a per counterparty limit of $80 billion per day. The per counterparty limit can be temporarily increased at the discretion of the chair. And prior to the March FOMC meeting, the per counterparty limit on reverse repos had been $30 billion. There was an earlier than unprecedented surge in Fed activity beginning in September of 2019. At that time, money was moving in the opposite direction, with the Fed loaning hundreds of billions of dollars a week in repo loans rather than reverse repo loans to its 24 Wall Street primary dealers, who just also happened to be the largest trading houses on Wall Street, many of them affiliates of the biggest of the two big-to-fail banks. Between September 18th and October 7th, 2019, here are some of the headlines Wall Street on Parade recounted. These are headlines of its own daily newsletter. Fed says it will offer $310 billion more in term loans to Wall Street as over 68,000 job cuts planned at mega banks. There's nothing normal about the Fed pumping hundreds of billions weekly to unnamed bank on Wall Street. Quote, somebody's got a problem. Next, JP Morgan Chase has a pattern of criminality Now Wall Street is pointing to the bank as a cause of the Fed's emergency loans. Yeah. Remember that one. It's about time. The Fed is offering $100 billion a day in emergency loans to unnamed banks, and Congress is not curious enough to hold a hearing. Well, the Martins conclude with this observation. The one point that everyone seems to agree on is that the Fed has inserted itself far too deeply into the markets and will have one major challenge detaching itself without causing a major market upheaval. That detachment, as we heard in pieces earlier in the program, and we've been hearing off and on the last couple of weeks, is inevitable. Now, it still might be 6 months, a year, 18 months, perhaps even 2 years away, depending on what happens. And it's going to be reluctant as can be, because we know there's going to be a major initial hit to paper markets when they do make that decision. But they can't prop up markets forever. My advice, ladies and gentlemen, protect yourselves with the safe haven, with the one true store of value, gold and silver. Call Melody at 1-800-375-4188. Now, here's an interesting article, something we don't, most of us don't think about a lot. Perhaps those of us who have kids, particularly those who like video games or who have smartphones, may know more about, but gaming on mobile and PCs is by far the fastest growing sector globally within the media and entertainment industry. That's according to a study by PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC for short these days. Streaming video is also experiencing explosive growth. While these sectors were always poised to get bigger as the internet developed, the pandemic has seriously hastened their growth, and is forcing the world's biggest media companies to reorient their businesses faster than many were prepared to do before. A slew of new media mergers shows that entertainment giants are moving quickly to consolidate even further, to have enough content at scale to compete in streaming. The recently announced but not yet approved Discovery WarnerMedia deal has triggered a new round of merger action as its peers scramble to meet its size. Shortly after the proposed merger was announced, Amazon said it would buy MGM, one of the last remaining independent movie studios in the country. That deal then sparked a new conversation among analysts and media insiders about which company would be next. AMC Networks and Lionsgate are now considered ripe targets. Rumors about deals with Comcast NBCU and Viacom CBS have also gotten attention. While traditional media giants focus on getting bigger to compete with tech giants are even eyeing an even bigger fish, gaming itself. Netflix is reportedly hiring a gaming chief as it seeks to expand even further into games, particularly on mobile. Google, Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon have increased their investments in cloud gaming with an eye toward making more money from video game subscriptions. But there's a catch. All but Microsoft have struggled to make it, as big a splash as they had hoped. Gaming's growing so fast. It's poised to one day surpass pay TV subscriptions in revenue. Pay TV is said to be in a terminal decline here in the U.S. and faces a similarly bleak outlook abroad as broadband becomes more globally accessible. For a long time, many of the country's biggest content companies like Disney, Viacom CBS, and Comcast NBCU made most of their money from pay TV subscriptions and advertising. Well, those companies are the ones that are struggling the most now to balance investments in streaming, because for now, pay TV is still big enough to bring sizable revenues and profits, but it won't be, they say, for too much longer. So a very interesting trend. Now, in the time we have remaining in the program, Giles, I guess you call it Giles Demonuth. It could be Gillis too, but I'm going to say Giles. He's a data scientist with the Bank of New Zealand in Auckland, and he was diagnosed with Asperger syndrome 10 years ago and believes that it's given him a professional advantage. He says, "I'm very good at finding patterns in data when other people see nothing. Early last spring, as cities worldwide were shutting down to halt the spread of COVID, Demonuth began reading up on the origin of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes the disease. The prevailing theory was that it had jumped from bats to some other species before making the leap to humans at a market in China, where some of the early cases appeared in late 2019. Now, we're going to run out of time, so I'm not going to go too much farther into this. We'll pick this up next week, because it is an interesting story where, you know, there's another side to. For now, we're going to take this opportunity to say thank you so much for tuning in to today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody will not be in, I think we don't have a program tomorrow, in fact, but be on the lookout for our weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog in your email inboxes tomorrow. For now, thanks for listening, have a good evening, and please, please, be safe out there. Bye-bye.